See, I'm a deep believer of the fact that, you know, if you are starved for money, you are going to build the business the right way. Excess money, easy money, companies and startups, you know, lost their way. They got carried away. And for example, one assumption they made was that any problem, as long as it is big, you can go out and build large and valuable companies. Not true at all. There's many problems of India are large. By solving these problems, large and valuable, is not very easy. And many of these problems are more amenable to being solved in a decentralized way and not in a hyper-scalable VC-funded model where one or two winners are going to emerge.
Hi, wherever you're listening to us, I hope you're doing well. Welcome to Startup Fridays, weekly conversations with accomplished entrepreneurs and VC investors. I'm Hari Arakli, and in this episode, T.N. Hari, co-founder of Artha School of Entrepreneurship, who's also a prolific author on Building for India and an angel investor, talks about his learnings from across his career, from being a corporate executive at Tata Steel many years ago to diving into startups like Taxi for Sure and Big Basket. He talks about problems in India that aren't necessarily amenable to the hyper-growth model of VC-funded startups. And he thinks aloud about the value of some highly effective leaders who are almost invisible to the public eye. So, Hari, good morning, sir, and thank you so much for making time for me on a Sunday. Really appreciate it. Welcome to Startup Fridays. Of course, Hari, within the startup ecosystem and in general also in the industry, your work is very well known and you've written several books and you continue to write leading newspapers. Just for a more general audience who may not be very familiar with your work, maybe you could start by attempting a quick snapshot of your career from IIT Madras to Artha School.
Got it. Great. So, Hari, I studied mechanical engineering at IIT Madras for some strange reason. You know, doing mechanical engineering at IIT Madras was my dream when I was in high school. I was very much interested in physics, but I realized teaching physics, you know, isn't going to pay in India. And I thought I'll do the next best thing. And IIT Madras was known as the best, school for mechanical engineering those days, probably one of the best in the world even. And there was a very strong, German collaboration. I enjoyed my 4 years stay there. I actually wanted to continue working as a mechanical engineer. And after finishing my graduation, you know, I wanted to pursue probably my master's from a top engineering school in the US. But, I wasn't the topper in my class. So I didn't really get admission into any of the top engineering schools. And I wasn't keen to study at, I'm not a great engineering school. So I decided to pursue a master's in business administration. And it wasn't to get, away from, engineering, not to run away from engineering, but to understand how organizations and companies work a little more holistically. And after my master's in, business administration from IIM Calcutta, I took up a job with Tata Steel working on the shop floor. For about 11 years, I worked on the shop floor wearing the hard hat, steel melting shops, so coke ovens, blast furnaces, everything that's there in a steel plant. And then I moved into the area of human capital after about 11 years, for the simple reason that in large companies, you get to rotate across functions. And at that point of time, post-liberalization, Tata Steel was going through a bit of a crisis. CIS countries were dumping steel in India at prices that were below our costs. And the company had to do something, otherwise it wouldn't have survived. 70,000 people producing 3 million tons of steel was just not okay. When 7,000 people just produce 3 million tons in steel plants in Japan, the US and Europe. At that point of time, we got in McKinsey to help us think through some of these things. At that point of time, Tata Steel also operated somewhat like this, which is very consultant-driven. They didn't have the ability to, solve difficult problems without, intellectual assistance from a consultant. And I was part of the core team that worked with McKinsey very closely on this project. This project was largely a human capital project because it involved right-sizing the organization, bringing in the right kind of culture, a culture of complacency had set in. Seniority, determined everything. It wasn't merit. and bloated headcount. So all of this needed some change, and it was essentially a human capital intervention. And that's when I realized that human capital can be extremely powerful and strategic in a company that's transforming. And that was a big realization for me. And at some point, I just felt that Tata Steel wasn't the right place for me because I was much of a rule breaker. I didn't want to consult five people and get their approval before doing something good. So I wanted to work in a very, you know, high, fast-paced, empowering kind of an environment where you could do things on your own as long as you did them with sincerity, integrity, and with right intent, and you could fail as well. And that's how I accidentally, you know, strayed into the world of startups. I had no idea when I was at Tata Steel what a startup really meant. Although I knew that the services companies, you know, companies like Infosys and all began their lives as startups, but I just didn't know much more beyond that. And when I, in fact, interviewed at this company called Daksh, I had no clue what business process outsourcing was. I understood this world of steelmaking. And BPO was very, very different. How can people sitting in a place in Gurgaon be answering questions of customers in the US and Europe? And how can this company make money? What do they really do? I had no idea. But I just liked the people. When I met them, I liked Sanjeev Agarwal. I met, and I met a few others as well. I liked all of them. And my gut feel all my life has been that if you work with interesting people, things will eventually work out. Good people and interesting people. So that's how I, you know, took a bet. And I remember seeing Sanjeev Agarwal's notes later on after joining the company where he had written in the interview sheet that does not really have much of hands-on experience in the area of human capital, but is a first principles thinker, extremely intelligent, and can figure out things. So I think they took the bet on getting me from a steel background into a fast-paced BPO startup background. And for me, it was no looking back after that. I just began to enjoy that atmosphere thoroughly and wondered why I wasn't here much earlier. And after that, it was a string of five high-growth startups. Three of them turned out to be unicorns. One company we listed on NASDAQ, and currently I've, you know, doing a school for entrepreneurship. Actually, of the last 20 years, the last 7 years with Big Basket, I've spent time, you know, engaging the ecosystem in a much broader way. Prior to that, I spent my time entirely with the company I worked for, helped it scale, build teams, solve problems, solve complex problems, and eventually help find meaningful exits. But the last 7 years, I engaged the ecosystem and realized there were a lot of young founders who needed help. And with help, I just felt that the right kind of help, they will avoid, you know, being tripped up along the way. And I thought that could be an interesting and important contribution to make to an ecosystem which was becoming mainstream in India. And then in the process, I began writing, wrote 7 books in the last 7 years. In some ways, I prepared for this Artha School for Entrepreneurship. And some of us have been tossing around this idea. And we felt, you know, we were at a stage in life when it's important to be able to give back. And we started the School of Entrepreneurship as a Section 8 company. And we felt that we should solve the problem of scaling, because that's what we deeply understand, the 1 to 5 or 1 to 10 journey rather than 0 to 1. And the 0 to 1 journey typically is about how do you be an entrepreneur? And we realized that there's very little know-how about a person jumping into entrepreneurship, because, you know, starting or taking on entrepreneurship is far more about character and less about know-how. Whereas scaling, there is a big element of know-how. And that's what we thought we understand really well. And that's where we are with Artha School of Entrepreneurship.
So, I mean, in that sense, are you all attempting to codify your collective knowledge?
Yes, that's what we are trying to do. I think we are figuring out stuff along the way. We are like any other startup. You know, we are learning along the way, rapidly figuring out what business model would work, what kind of learnings are best imbibed by participants, what is the kind of approach we need to take. And we are doing this very diligently and thoughtfully. We are not a VC-funded startup that is hustling to, you know, do things at unreasonable pace. We want to, you know, pause and enjoy the beauty along this lovely journey. We want to do things very thoughtfully, and we want to do things that we love to do. So, yes, we are discovering our journey. We are discovering the right kind of business model. But gradually, we are coming to the realization that, you know, more than helping the VC-funded startup scale or hyperscale, I mean, we certainly have a very strong competence in that domain. But we feel, deeply in our hearts that that is where we want to create impact. because that's a very, very commercial setup where these guys have already been funded. They don't know what they don't know. And their hunger to learn is less. And they're pretty much confident that with a lot of capital, they will somehow figure their journey. So gradually we're realizing that our impact is far more effective. We can touch the lives of thousands of entrepreneurs across the length and breadth of the country in tier two, tier three towns. Help the underprivileged entrepreneurs who don't have access to, you know, this kind of expert help, and help those kind of entrepreneurs is gradually something that we are veering towards.
So, is there like a like a flagship course at Artha? And now, how many years have you been running this school?
We've been running it for exactly 1 year. And we've touched the lives of 150 plus entrepreneurs. Every entrepreneur who participated in our workshop has given us amazing feedback. And I'm not saying this for the sake of saying this because there's nothing in it for us by saying this. So our NPS scores and Net Promoter scores have all been 91% plus. And we have one flagship program, which is a 3 to 4 day workshop, depending upon the needs of the entrepreneurs. And in those 3-4 days of intense activity and instruction, we help founders learn aspects of scaling that are sector and domain agnostic. So you can put a person who is trying to, for example, develop a D2C business from Kochi for hair care products into the same room as somebody who is doing a SaaS product, both in the scaling journey. And there are lots of commonality in some terms of building team, in terms of understanding culture, in terms of, you know, creating alignment and conducting the reviews around, you know, very sharply defined high priority OKRs, for instance, the right kind of organization structure, getting that, understanding culture deeply and making it work for you, not just parroting the standard politically correct phrases about culture, but deeply, deeply understanding what your culture is and how to make it work for you. Storytelling, fundraising, you know, a clarity of uncluttered thinking, building a business sustainably. So these are topics which are actually sector agnostic, and we cover all of these topics. And that's our flagship program.
And is this like a modular structure where people can select the ones that are really relevant to them?
No, these are 4 days, 3 to 4 days is absolutely, you have to stay for all the 3 or 4 days.
Okay. And it's residential as well, is it?
Yes. We do it in person. That's correct.
Okay. Very nice. Okay. You talked about, going beyond sort of making the right noises about culture and things like that, and getting into the nitty-gritties of what really makes for a culture that gets, that empowers people, gets them to do their best. Today, I would imagine that if you look at the collective knowledge of all the academic work and of course, corporate businesses, when it comes to managing people, I suppose it's a lot more data-driven and it's more of a science. So in your experience, do corporate leaders, HR heads, do you all look at what makes employees the happiest in a particular role, in a particular company? And I suppose that kind of goes towards how you retain employees, how you get the best out of them and things like that. And I suppose in that sense, I guess it translates to the bottom line and so on.
Yeah. So I think there are 2-3 questions, around what you've spoken. I think let me just begin with elements of culture. Let me just demystify this concept and, take away some of the usual cobwebs around this topic. So the best way to understand culture is to, take a parallel from an individual world, which is that all of us as individuals have our own personalities, and every personality is different. And all of us are destined to succeed. There is no good or bad personality. For example, some people are very, very comfortable with numbers, can, are quantitative in the way they look at this world. And there are some people who can go out and meet new kinds of people and woo them. And there are some people who are very creative. There are a variety of people, but nothing is good or bad. All these talents are essential. And you need to play to your strengths, recognize who you are as a person, not worry about imitating those you cannot resemble, but just be aware of who you are. And the same, analogy applies to companies as well. There is no good or bad culture. And for the moment, I'm keeping away toxic elements So if you just keep away the toxic elements, and there are toxic elements in personalities as well. So if you keep those out, there is really no good culture or bad culture. So for instance, if you take a company like Amazon, Amazon is an extremely aggressive culture. 50% of the people who ever worked with Amazon love it, and 50% hate it. Those who love it say that this company is transforming, you know, the way the world works. And therefore, unless you are aggressive in the way you get things done, you're not able to create, you won't be able to create an impact. And the 50% who hate it say, you know, this kind of aggression is just no good because there's no work-life balance for employees. You know, I get home at 10 o'clock at night and you send me an email and you expect me to respond in 20 minutes. And if I don't respond, there is a follow-up call. So this is not okay. So even within the same company, you know, there are people who love it, there are people who, you know, hate it. If you just take, I've worked for many companies, all of them extremely good, successful companies that I respected and love to work for, but very different cultures. So for example, a company like Daksh and a company like Big Basket, you know, nice comparison and contrast they make. So Big Basket is a company where you can never be fired for underperformance. This is a company that, you know, loves to take care of its people and helps create a collaborative environment at the workplace. And if you don't, you know, succeed, the company will give you multiple alternatives, multiple, you know, opportunities to succeed. And even if you fail, even after that, but if you demonstrate the right kind of intent, you know, value systems, ethics, then the company will still keep you. Whereas at a company like Daksh, for instance, they were very, very clearly aggressive and accountable, which is that if you didn't deliver in 2 quarters, you will be given the right kind of messages, which is that you better find a place where things will work for you. And that company was very customer-centric. Big Basket was very customer-centric too. And I think, you know, to a large extent, this depends on the personality of the founders. So for, in a startup, culture equals the founder personality, nothing else. So the founder beliefs on what is right, what is wrong, what makes things work is all eventually going to, you know, permeate into the fabric of a company's culture. So the Daksh founders were one type, the Big Basket founders and their life experiences were very different. I can go on and on. So, you know, culture is really about you as a company deeply understanding what are your strengths and making it work for you. For example, if you're a Big Basket, it doesn't make sense to say, you know what, Ola is growing rapidly because they have centralized decision making. They take things quickly. They take high risks. So we should do what they do. It will fail spectacularly if Big Basket imitates Ola. And Ola will fail spectacularly if they try and imitate Big Basket because the two are different personalities in terms of, you know, cultures. So that briefly is about culture. So culture is therefore about creating self-awareness. Like all of us as individuals, we need to be self-aware. What we are good at, what we are not good at. Who am I? What's my identity? And that's the same thing about company's culture as well. Then you talked about, I think this one other question was about, you know, how do people, you know, what do people have to do to find happiness at work? And how do you hire the right kind of people? I think there are a couple of things embedded there. I deeply believe that, you know what, it's very important for individuals when they are looking for a job to be able to figure out whether there is an alignment in their own beliefs and values with this values and beliefs of the company that they are going to work for. If the alignment is not there, then I think it's going to create some trouble eventually in the long run. So there should be alignment of beliefs, alignment of value systems, alignment in the way things need to get done. The second is that, you know what, whatever job an individual takes up, you should enjoy doing the activities relevant to the job every day. Because ultimately, every day you're going to be doing something. And if that doesn't give you happiness, if it puts pressure on you, then you're going to burn out. For example, if you are not a person comfortable with giving harsh feedback to team members or having crucial conversations on a daily basis, but if your job requires you to do that, you are going to burn out. So you have to take up a job where the activities that you need to perform on a daily basis, you're going to be very comfortable and they play to your strengths. Also, it's very important to have a nice set of peers, people you can learn from, people who you love to hang out with. That's a very important element of work as well. The other element is that I think you should also, you know, there should be room for failure. If you are able to take some risk and if you make some mistakes and if you fail, then, you know, you should not be penalized for that. So there should be, I would say, room for failure as well. So I think a few things like these come together And I would just go to the extent of saying, you know, compensation is not a very important element of happiness. It gives you happiness the day you get a job with high compensation. But the point is that compensation doesn't happen to you every day. It's a one-time affair. It gives you an amazing degree of happiness on that day. And it's going to taper off after some time. But your commute to work is something that you have to go through every day. So if you're commuting for 3 hours, 2.5 hours to bad traffic and driving, and you have a high compensation, very soon the bad traffic negativity is going to overtake the positivity that high compensation created. So anything that gives you trouble on a daily basis, whether it is commute or the kind of peers you interact with, eventually will contribute to unhappiness. And stuff that you are doing on a daily basis, if it gives you joy, then that's eventually going to create happiness. So broadly, that's my thought about happiness at the workplace.
Okay. I mean, within this, I'm wondering if there is a subset of practices related to culture. And in some of the startups which became large organizations, and you played a role in building them to becoming those large organizations. And also in the context of Big Basket, I think you've also written about encouraging, fostering science and data-based innovation, not just Jugaad.
Yeah.
So the original question about the subset was, I'm thinking if you've explored ways of seriously fostering innovation and experimentation and getting people to realize that they don't have to be afraid or even ashamed of failure. What are the elements of such a culture, and especially in the context of the development of Indian startups?
Yeah, so I think here again, there are, you know, multiple elements to your question. So let me just talk a little bit about, fostering an innovative or innovation-based culture. So I think the reality is that no company can be the best at everything. It can't disrupt innovatively. I mean, a company that can disrupt innovatively, can demonstrate operational excellence, can come up with wonderful products, and has a great people culture, financially savvy, you are never going to find a company like that, which is perfect in everything. So just think about a company like Big Basket, right? Or even a company like Amazon. What they do, if you ask me, is it really innovative? I would say, you know, making steel or making a motor car is far more innovative and involves far more complexity than being able to do home delivery of grocery. Home delivery of grocery at one level is not innovative at all. It was just the idea which was good, which is that there are a set of people who face inconvenience, don't, you know, like to go through bad traffic and don't enjoy, you know, buying grocery. So this was solving a genuine problem, but was it disruptive innovation? Answer is clearly no. So I think the question then really is, what does disruptive innovation mean and what are the nuances of innovation? You know, Seffi Beckel in his book Loon Shots, I think, provides an insight to this. And he says, you know, that there are two dimensions along which you can slice, you know, something and you can figure out the nature of innovation. So, for example, broadly, he says there are two types of innovators, the P-type innovators and the S-type innovators. The P-type innovators are those who are able to come up with some amazing product. For example, you know, a solar cooker is to be a P-type innovation. A photocopying machine is a P-type innovation. A Polaroid camera is a P-type innovation. It needs some amazing breakthrough where you bring in technology, understand a customer need or understand what can solve a customer problem and come up with a wonderful product. A jet engine is a P-type innovation. But he also says the S-type of innovations. And that's what Big Basket does really well. And for someone who's standing on the outside, an S-type innovation doesn't even look like an innovation. It is about being able to bring process, technology, training, audit, operations, everything together in such a seamless way that this company is able to create an amazing customer experience consistently over millions of transactions. And that is an S-type innovation. So delivering grocery to your home, you know, and doing that for 100 customers is very easy. But if you have to deliver a grocery where a customer orders 30 items or 40 items and doing this over millions of orders across the country in hundreds of cities, you know, without fail, you know, with that same consistent, awesome experience, that is innovation. Because you can't do that kind of consistency unless you bring a deep understanding of process knowledge, deep understanding of technology, deep understanding of training about human capital. How do you even conduct audits so that, you know, those who are not following the process are quickly identified and they are put through, you know, either refresher training or they're sent out of the company. So I think this to me is S-type innovation. So I think it's very important to be able to identify. And S-type of innovation is about being able to bring all these together very seamlessly. And that's what companies like BigBasket and Swiggy do very well. So neither of them are coming out with great products, but they're coming up with the S type of innovation. So to me, I would like to distinguish between the different types of innovation like this. So I would say, you know what, as I mentioned to you, what BigBasket did at some level or what Swiggy is doing at some level is not rocket science, but it's not easy to do that as well. And if you ask me why, I think the reasons are somewhat like this. You need to have tremendous amount of clarity on what you know is going to work. And you should not be carried away by hype and noise. So, for example, in 2014, BigBasket, like any other e-commerce company that was, you know, burning a lot of cash, was in the market to raise money. And Tiger Global was a big player in this space. Leaf XL, you know, had bankrolled pretty much the entire e-commerce sector in India. And the BigBasket team was raising money, was looking at raising money from Tiger Global as well. And it was, sometime in August, September, rainy day in Bangalore, Leaf XL and Kalyan Krishnamurthy, who was then a partner at Tiger Global, turned up at the BigBasket office. And after some initial discussions in less than 20, 30 minutes, both of them told us, you know, in pretty much, a very candid way that your business model sucks. And you guys will never be able to scale. And there are younger players who are smarter than you guys who will come and scale and build businesses. And your guys are going to be in trouble. And the reason they told us was you are building an inventory-led model, whereas the way forward is an asset-light model. Ours was an asset-heavy model. And what does an asset-light model means? It means that if you want to expand into a new city in India, say Jodhpur, then all you need to go to Jodhpur, hire 20 delivery boys, give them an app and a phone and station them outside a local Big Bazaar store. And when customers order, enter the store, pick up stuff and deliver stuff. So they said that that's an asset-light model and you can expand to hundreds of cities in India very quickly. And they were so dumb. You know, if you just look at these business models, they have zero chance of success, all of these. So BigBasket had, you know, to take a call, you know, say that we won't take money from Tiger Global and therefore subsequently from SoftBank. But we will, or we should we change our business model to suit what these guys are interested in and then scale along with, you know, their approach and get in a lot of money. So it needs character to be able to stick to you what you know is right. You know, Galileo was told that the earth, sun goes round the earth by both the Pope and the church. But it needed some character to be able to say, no, you guys are wrong. I know it for sure. So I think BigBasket clearly understood that it's not going to work. And I can go on about it and go into the deep reasons as to why we were so clear it won't work. But that's not the story for today. So I think, you know what, building a company like this, this kind of very process-centric, you know, execution-focused, putting your head down, hunkering down and doing the right stuff every day calls for character. In being able to stick to, you know, what is right and not just drifting with the, you know, prevailing winds. So I think from that perspective, I think to me, companies that would succeed in the future going forward are those that are confident about themselves, are building a business in a sustainable way, don't care about what, you know, Excel sheet driven 25-year-old venture capitalists tell them is right and wrong. So I think that is very crucial.
Any interesting names come to your mind of people that you've, you know, come to consider as exceptional startup founders in India?
There are quite a few, actually. And I was, talking to someone the other day, you know, in this book called Good to Great, you know, Jim Collins talks of level five leaders. Level five leaders are those who deliberately avoid publicity. They avoid PR. They operate under the radar. For them, the brand of the company matters far more than their personal brands. So just as nobody knows level five leaders, everybody knows, for example, Sanjeev Bikhchandani, for example. Everybody knows, for example, you know, Deep Kalra. But who knows Sudhakar? Sudhakar is the man who has built BigBasket. He is the heart and soul of this company. If someday a biography was to be written about Bajaj, I am not keen to read the biography of Jamnalal Bajaj. I'm sure he's a great man, but I won't read the biography of Sudhakar if I was not part of Big Basket. Those are the kind of leaders I want to read about. So nobody knows about them, and that's the reality. And the truth is that even when it comes to building companies and startups, the best companies are not talked about by the media because they don't have a sexy story. They're building a business by hunkering down and doing all the right things. There is nothing newsy about building businesses. It's a boring affair, building great companies. So I would say that, you know, they're not easily spotable. But having said that, if you look at companies like, for example, InMobi, I think it's a great company. The founder has been at it for so many years outside the radar. So a company like Swiggy, a company like Big Basket, a company like Book My Show, a company like Urban Company, they've discovered, you know, things along the way, executed very quietly, executed well, did all the fundamentals right. For example, all of these companies are able to recognize, for example, building the right kind of governance, building the right kind of culture, human capital practices, treating people with fairness, honesty, transparency. It has a direct correlation and impact on business outcomes. So these are things that many of these companies understand. Whereas those under hype, like a Byju's, for example, they have no clue what is the relationship between governance and human capital practices versus business outcomes. As a result of which, they treat the two separately. And you know the consequences of all these companies that are just, you know, coming off. So I would say I've taken some names in there. And I would say there are many, many more like this. For example, a company like Dehat. Very, very grounded company, five founders solving the problem of farmers in India, agri-tech company, building business the right way. And there are many like this who are doing it in the sound way. And I think, you know, gradually the people will begin to talk about more and more about these companies. But I would say, nevertheless, at the end of the day, these companies don't make for good stories.
Okay, that's an interesting point. In your conversations with entrepreneurs and others in your network today, what do you see them doing today in the context of the what folks now call as the funding winter? Of course, it's not the first, won't be the last, but in the current context of, you know, maybe it's a little bit more difficult for some of these companies to find funding, discussions may be taking longer, etc. What are some of the things that you see these entrepreneurs doing now?
See, I am a deep believer of the fact that, you know, if you are starved for money, you are going to build a business the right way. Excess money, easy money is the best way to kill the business. So I think we've seen a lot of that happen in the last five, six years. Easy money was, you know, the, you know, prevailing formula. And for various reasons, interest rates were low, quantitative easing happened, especially during the COVID years. The Federal Reserve in the US printed more money in the last 2 years than it had printed in the prior 50-year period. So, you know, something like this was going to come, which is they had to tighten. And the easy money, you know, made capital available in abundance. Companies and startups, you know, lost their way. They got carried away. They built businesses the wrong way. They developed bad habits along the way. And for example, one assumption they made was that any problem, as long as it is big, you can go out and build large and valuable companies. So a large addressable market means you can go out and build valuable companies. Not true at all. There's many problems of India are large. You know, primary education problem in India is large. Skilling, jobs, employment, they are all healthcare, complex and large problems. But building companies by solving these problems, large and valuable, is not very easy. And many of these problems are more amenable to being solved in a decentralized way and not in a hyper-scalable VC-funded model where one or two winners are going to emerge. So I think one assumption they made was completely wrong, as a result of which they tried to use technology to solve many problems where technology was simply not a game changer. In taxi aggregation, for example, technology proved to be an amazing game changer. Because you can't find a cab without the platform and the driver can't find a customer without the platform. So the platform was disintermediable and it solved a real problem. But the same technology applied in other areas, whether it was in, for example, you know, property tech or in ed tech, wasn't fitting this, which is that they could be disintermediated. There was no real problem that they were solving. So all I would say is that, you know, this funding winter to me is a very good thing to happen. the easy money had created all the wrong kind of role models for the startup ecosystem. India's progress towards prosperity is only going to happen if entrepreneurship can happen on scale. And in the last 6-7 years, there were some good role models, but largely not the kind of role models that a country like India needs. So I think the funding winter is going to set that thing right. And I think we are going to have good role models, because these are companies that will survive and stay, whereas those that were considered cool, all of them one by one are falling off, and all of them will fall off eventually. They will not survive.
So if we extend this idea of what the current slowdown is surfacing, can you stand back and look at the whole ecosystem and give us your sense of what are some of the strengths of the Indian ecosystem, startup ecosystem today, and what are some critical weaknesses that are emerging?
So I think, the strengths of one of the biggest strengths of the Indian ecosystem is that India was historically known for being an entrepreneurial nation. We were never a warrior nation. If you look at history, we were easily conquered by invaders because we were not a warrior race, but we were a race of entrepreneurs. India was known as the country of shopkeepers. So I think entrepreneurship naturally comes to many people in India. But I think, the first 45 years of independence, the country went down the path of, the government taking on the commanding heights of the economy, profit being a bad word, completely discouraging entrepreneurs, harassing them. So I think, smart people just didn't want to stay in India and become entrepreneurs. They didn't even want to take jobs. They just wanted to migrate to better countries, more prosperous countries. But I think 1991 forced our hand and we were forced to liberalize, open up the markets. And gradually you had first generation entrepreneurs who used the Y2K opportunity, built amazing services companies. We capitalized on that opportunity, English speaking nation. And we built today, there are, multi-billion dollar companies, TCS, rivals, IBM, whoever thought that an Indian tech company would rival an American tech company. And, the IT services companies in India together collectively contribute to an amazing market cap of 5 million jobs. So I think, the next generation of entrepreneurship came sometime in 2008 with the setting up of Flipkart, where first generation entrepreneur for the first time began solving the problems of India. Infosys, TCS solved the problems of the West, high labor cost. But these companies began solving the wicked problems of India, which we all thought were unsolvable. When we were young, we thought these are all problems which are unsolvable. But these guys began taking, up these problems, and they were funded by VC money and had the guts. So I think while it produced a lot of companies that did not survive, it also produced some amazing winners. So capital, has its positives and negatives. The positive is that it allows some problems which otherwise cannot be solved to be solved. So I think capital helped, create this new generation of entrepreneurs and a belief that we can solve our own problems. But I think the reality had to set in sometime very soon, which is that capital cannot be an answer to every problem. And the fact that solving the problems of those Indians who are in the top 70 to 100 million in the pyramid, economic, socio-economic pyramid, is relatively easy. But solving the problems of the next 400, 500 million Indians is not going to be easy, because their ability to pay is very different. Their expectations from a product is very different. The way you need to build a product is very different. And it's a very difficult journey building companies for those who cannot afford to pay. It needs far more, thinking out of the box. So I think what is this funding winter is demonstrating is that it is helping founders to think about how to build products in a frugal manner. Because you cannot build companies for these 400 million unless you are frugal, unless you are, if you are spending even a penny on features that don't add value to customer or customer don't care about, then that's a waste. So I think the funding winter is bringing back some good habits. And I think the prior, era of entrepreneurship, Flipkart era, gave the ecosystem confidence that we can try our hand at entrepreneurship. So I think we are in the best place at this point of time.
And you also captured your thoughts in your book with Bala on Middle India, and you just referred to the next 400, 500 million yes. Indians. Can you talk about that a bit more? The entrepreneurs who have come some way in succeeding in building businesses, solving large problems for this half a billion cohort of Indians who can't pay much on a daily or even a monthly basis. Yeah. What are these entrepreneurs getting right?
So I'll just give you an example that will illustrate the way one needs to think about the next 400 million consumers. If you go back to our childhood, you might remember this gentleman called Chinni Krishnan. He came from a small town in Tamil Nadu called Kadalur. And he worked very closely with those, in the farm sector, the blue-collar workers working in the factories. And he realized that these guys don't have the ability to pay, but their aspiration is high. And they earn, a living. Their living is hand-to-mouth, which is their cash flow is very poor. And at no point of time do they have a large amount of surplus money that they could spend on consumer products. But they could therefore spend money on same consumer products if they were in small packets. So instead of a 500 ml shampoo bottle, he came up with a sachet of shampoo with just 5 ml. So these guys could buy that product because they were wanting to use shampoo once in a while, especially on important occasions. So I think he understood the customer need and figured out how to deliver that 5 ml shampoo. To me, that was one of India's greatest innovations that companies like HUL and several other MNCs blindly copied. Today, 70% or 60-70% of all the shampoo sold in India is in the form of sachets. And his son, Chinni Krishnan's son, C.K. Ranganathan, I just happened to meet him in Chennai recently, he actually took forward that idea and has built an amazing, FMCG company by name Cavincare. So I think in this story lies the secret of building products for middle India, which is those who cannot really pay for products. So it is about a deep understanding of their problem, their aspiration, and finding out how I can solve the problem in a way that addresses their, wallets as well as their needs. So I think if you just look back at that story, I think several companies that are trying to build products for middle India are doing something similar, which is deeply understanding the consumers, identifying the problem, not providing a single frill that these customers don't care about, building a bare minimum product, and not providing conveniences that they don't care for, solving a real problem, building a long-term relationship and trust. Because these are people who will not shop with you. They inherently suspect businesses. They inherently suspect the urban Indians who are setting up products as companies to sell them products. They are inherently suspicious. It's very important, therefore, build an amazing level of trust. Trust through, build it through one product. And after that, you can keep on adding products and they will believe you. So I think it's important to be able to build a frugal company, understand customer needs, build the trust deeply, and figure out what is their paying capacity, and from there build a product that will bear that price, which is low cost enough to be able to yet provide you some reasonable profit.
And if you look at it from the entrepreneur's side of things, I mean, rather, if you wear your investor's hat, I mean, you're an investor mentor to many founders. When you invest in an entrepreneur like this, what are the characteristics that you look for? What are the check boxes that are not negotiable?
Yeah. So one thing which is very, very clear, to me certainly, is that ideas can come dime a dozen, which is that ideas mean nothing. You put five smart people from college into a room and lock them up for 2 days and ask them to come up with ideas. They will come up with 25 best ideas that can change the course of humanity. No doubt about that. But this is not going to change the course of humanity. What is going to change the course of humanity is a founder who can take this wonderful idea and build an enterprise, commercial enterprise around that. And the difficulty of building a commercial enterprise around an idea is that you have to go through a lot of difficulties. You have to go through lots of ups and downs. There will be near-death moments. You will have to make tweaks to your business model. You have to fire people. You have to change your product. You might have to pivot. And these are not for the weak-hearted. So building a company is not for the weak-hearted at all. So I think it's about finding people who are going to be resilient, who are able to apply first principles thinking on a daily basis to solve problems, who have the stamina to go through the journey and not give up, about people who can bounce back, about people who can say, I don't know, people who don't pretend to have all the answers, people who are confident about themselves at one level and are also able to ask questions about others to learn. So it's a strange combination, which is curiosity on the one hand and confidence. Because normally you assume those who are confident are not going to ask questions, but you need a strange combination. You need people who have that amazing combination of being very assertive in getting the great discussions around a topic and yet being very humble at a personal level. So I would think that these are some of the traits that really, really matter in founders.
Can you think back and look at some of the instances where you felt the most outside your comfort zone, either because you deliberately wanted to learn some new thing or because of happenstance? And what did those experiences teach you?
Yeah, that's a probably easier question to answer. So I think, I have taken sufficient number of moderate risks, probably more risks than many people, but not as much risk as entrepreneurs take when they quit jobs. So for instance, moving from, engineering, hardcore engineering, a steel plant-based context to a human capital function in a BPO company, to me was a big amount of risk. In the first, because culturally, these two companies were very different. In a company like Tata Steel, it was a pretty hierarchical company. The bosses decided what you had to do. You had to take a notebook to the meeting and the pen, take down notes and just go back and get things done. You could ask a few questions, but not too many questions. So at a place like Daksh, it was just exactly the opposite. If you couldn't ask questions, if you couldn't question the status quo, if you couldn't get things done, if you expected a boss to do things and tell you what to do and you would do it, you would be fired the next day. And despite my being a rule breaker and being an entrepreneur at Tata Steel, at Daksh, I thought in the first 2 months, I'm going to get fired. So that was the kind of experience I had. It was to me, in reality, for a middle-class person who was trying to come out of a family background of, I would say poverty is the wrong term, but we were not financially well off, but trying to come out of that and the fear of getting fired, I thought, was to me a near-death moment. My wife and I used to always wonder what would happen to us when we reflect about that chapter in our lives. But, I was a rule breaker. I told you in 2 months, I realized that I was in the place that I really wanted to be. And the company actually began to love me because of that. My aggression, my ability to ask questions, my ability not to take a no for an answer. So Sanjeev began to love me. And Sanjeev, Sanjeev Agarwal, the founder, CEO at Daksh. Even to this day, we are associated. He's a donor. He's a co-founder at the Artha School for Entrepreneurship. He has been an investor in some of the companies that I, worked for. So, that was probably what came nearest. And the second probably big one for me was after Amba Research, when I decided to work for Taxi for Sure. I was around, I think if I remember, 47, 48 years old. And the founder, CEO Raghunandan, was 32 years old. So deciding to work for a very young founder was a risk that very few people would take. But I took that risk and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And for me, that was another turning point in my life. There have been many turning points. This was one turning point, which is my ability to re-engage the younger generation of people, add value to their journeys, be a part of them, learn from them in the process. And whenever I have conversations with young people, mentor founders, I don't see that as mentoring. In fact, I really don't like that word mentoring because I end up learning a lot and I end up asking them a lot of questions. I push them. So I'm a good sounding board with them rather than telling them what to do. And in the process, I learn. So it's a, virtuous cycle. Conversations with them, they learn, I learn. Because I learn, I can do new things. Because I do the new things, I again learn. So for me, the last 7 years has been so fulfilling in terms of the number of topics that I have learned, gained mastery over, right from, non-governmental kind of work, social impact work, commercial, very, very profit-seeking kind of enterprises. All kinds of people I have met in my life in the last 7 years, and very, very fulfilling that way. So moderate risks and very, very fulfilling.
Okay. You started out by saying that you switched from HR, or rather you were in an HR role because rotations were allowed and so on. I'm curious about what got you interested in HR.
So for me, it was entirely an accident, Hari. So I told you in large companies, if you are reasonably smart, you're expected to rotate across diverse functions because you're expected to take on general manager responsibilities. Mm. So at this point, at no point of time I ever thought I will move into human capital. I thought, no, I might someday move into marketing steel. I might move into FP&A in finance. Well, I never thought human capital. I thought, what's human capital all about? Managing unions and, you know, the personal function, welfare activities. But then I've, you know, all my life, I have just gone by trusting good people. I have an amazing intuition for good people. And I just blindly trust them and associate with them for life. So Nirup Mahanty was, you know, the person who was the VP HR at Tata Steel. And he was able to very quickly let me communicate to me why this role was so important. And once I took on that role, I realized that, my goodness, this is an amazing function. If you really want to apply first principles thinking and take this function and help it create a strategic impact for the company, you can absolutely do it. So that's how I moved into HR. For me, it was an accident. It was never by design or by, you know, thinking about it carefully.
Any names that might come to your mind? I mean, off the top of your mind, people that you recruited. I'm thinking that you have recruited either directly or through your teams across the spectrum, maybe expanding Taxi for Sure's driver network to, you know, recruiting folks for warehouses at Taxi, at Big Basket, to very senior leaders at CEO levels. Any interesting anecdotes or people that you successfully recruited, or one or two leaders that you wanted to hire but couldn't get them? Anything that comes to your mind?
All kinds, Hari. The hiring and scaling the blue collar workforce in a company like Taxi for Sure and a company like Big Basket, to me, was probably the most fulfilling, especially at Big Basket, getting this company from a few thousand people to 40,000 people in 7 years. Spread across the length and breadth of the country, working in warehouses, doing last mile deliveries. And at the end of it, you know, you can't control the quality of every hire. But at the end of it, you can create mechanisms in place that will ensure that these 40,000 are able to largely work as a coherent group of people, believing that this is an honest and fair company to work for. So creating conditions of fairness, transparency, and commitment to these workers, I think, was something that I was able to successfully create at Big Basket. To me, that's the greatest amount of satisfaction. We hired hundreds and gradually thousands of women in warehouses, which, you know, and typically women are not hired into these kind of roles. But we created an amazing environment of a safe workplace for women, and we're able to communicate this across the length and breadth of the country. And every woman in the company saw us as a fair company where there will be absolutely no discrimination. If there is any discrimination, if there's any harassment, the law will act very swiftly, and the, you know, corrective actions are going to happen very soon. So to me, that was very satisfying. In other companies, including Big Basket, we also hired a lot of senior people. Some did not work out, a few did not work out, and they provided a lot of lessons in terms of, you know, what are some of the red flags in leadership hiring, what do you really need to be careful about. So those were some amazing lessons, you know. And for example, one lesson that's really I will never forget is that those who, you know, are can operate in scale need not necessarily be those who can build for scale. So when a company is scaling, startup, you tend to hire from companies that have already scaled and executives who are managing in their scale environment. Many of them just can't come and build for scale, because building for scale is a completely different kettle of fish. You need to be hands-on. You need to be able to solve problems. You need to be able to roll up your sleeves and get things done. If you have to build for scale, you should not have forgotten your first principles. So I think that was one very important lesson. And the other lesson was that, you know what, do the right kind of reference checks. Talk to people who worked with these individuals. Don't do reference checks with the people that the candidate provides. References the candidate provides, they don't mean anything at all. You should find people who will be willing to give you, you know, accurate information about that candidate they may have seen or worked with very closely. So like that, there were many lessons. There were also lessons where, you know, places, times where we wanted to hire somebody, but we could not get that person. But I think market is very competitive. You need to make the best of whatever you get, and you will never always get the best. If you always got the best, then what's the need for you? What's the need for leadership and management if every problem is so easily solvable?
Looking really all the way back, what is your earliest memory, even from your childhood, of anything that now looking back might have influenced your professional career choices?
So Life, I believe, is about a combination of the proverbial nature and nurture. And I think, you know, nature, which is your DNA, which is the brain connections and highways that form in your mind, and why those highways form and differently in different individuals is slightly different to explain. But the highways in my mind that formed at a very early stage was extreme curiosity. I was an extremely curious kid. I mean, even to this day, there's a curious child in me. I watch hundreds of videos, you know, on YouTube in quantum mechanics to relativity, hoping someday that my understanding will be a little better. So curiosity, I think, was a very strong element of my DNA. And fortunately, it got nurtured as well by some of the people around me, some of the teachers around me. The other thing I realized was that is a combination of nature and nurture, which is uncluttered thinking, being able to connect the dots, see patterns much before the others, ask a lot of questions, which in turn would, through a chain of questions and answers, get to the root cause of a problem. And that I could do on any topic. It was not just in science or engineering. I could do that in history. I could do that in diversity and inclusion. I could use those principles in this chain of questions and answers, question and answers, in a diverse set of topics. And finally, ability to communicate, you know, and articulate difficult ideas in a manner that people can, anyone can easily understand. I think where both nature and nurture, they have influenced me for my whole life. Everything that I do, I do well because of these. I also was an incorrigible introvert when I was young. I continue to be an incorrigible introvert now. I was ashamed of my being an introvert until maybe I finished my post-graduation, even the early years of my career. But today I'm proud of it, because at Tata Steel in the early days, I thought, you know what, in corporate life requires networking, a lot of internal networking, being very socially savvy with, you know, management. And I felt I was not cut out for, you know, corporate world. But then I realized in last many years that, you know, you have your own way of finding your networks. There are people like you. Today, I am probably one of the most networked persons in the country. And the way I network is very different from the way I thought networking should be done. So I think the day you realize what you're good at and stop feeling ashamed about what you're not good at, I think that's the day you begin to, you know, realize the purpose for which you were born on this planet.
Where were you born? Where did you grow up? What did your parents do?
I was born in Bangalore, but within a few months of my being born, my father was transferred. He used to work for Hindustan Aeronautics Limited. He was transferred to HAL in Koraput district. Koraput is one of the most backward districts in the country. And a lot of public sector undertakings were consciously chosen, you know, to be set up in such places by the government of India. So we moved to Koraput district. I grew up in Koraput, which is the place since was Sonabeda in Koraput district. Grew up there. Studied from nursery up to the 12th grade. And my father was, you know, working in HA. And then afterwards, IIT, IIM journey, and the rest of my journey began.
What did he do at HAL?
My father was a diploma in electrical engineering. But like most people, you know, the kind of work that you do is very different from the thing that you were trained for. So he worked in the area of process methods engineering mostly.
Okay. What gives you your sense of purpose? And do you recall if there was any sort of, I don't know, moment when you realized sort of, this is my sense of purpose. This is what gives me, you know, every morning when you get up to attack the day, what is it that motivates you?
See, I don't place a lot of emphasis on purpose. I think purpose is, you know, hyped a lot and, you know, overvalued. I would say that, you know what, forget a sense of purpose. Identify who you are. Identify what your strengths are. What do you really enjoy doing? And if you can do that really well, and I try to do that for you, which is about my curiosity, uncluttered thinking, and communicating. If you start finding outlets for these strengths of yours, that's when purpose will begin to take shape. The exact nature of purpose can change as you progress, but these core strengths of yours will shape your purpose for the rest of your life if you understand them well. So for example, my ability to communicate and articulate difficult topics in an easy to understand manner didn't find an outlet until 7 years ago when I began to publish and write books. So I think gradually it begins to take shape. I never knew I will write books. But once I began writing books, communicating and explaining difficult concepts to people became one of the elements of my purpose. So purpose, I think, takes shape. But for me, creating impact with a wide variety of people, helping the underprivileged and the underdog to succeed in life, having deep compassion and empathy for them, seeking the truth, speaking my mind without fear, favor, I think those have been some of my elements and have shaped my purposes as my life evolved.
Okay, two questions, specific ones. The earlier response, you spoke about how you got to a point where you just stopped apologizing for who you were and, you know, not being ashamed of being an introvert. In the Indian startup context, a lot of folks have commented on how, as a culture, we are ashamed of failure. And I think that has had a bearing on our startup scene. Do you see that changing today?
So I think this is a bit of a nuanced question. So let me just take this. So I think in the last 10 years, clearly, failure is far more accepted than it used to be. And founders whose ideas have not succeeded are embraced, welcomed, and accepted by other startups which need their services and expertise. So I think undoubtedly that has changed. Failure has got more acceptance. But will those people who failed, whose ideas did not succeed, will they... their stories be talked about a lot? I don't think so. I mean, although today, for example, at a superficial level, everybody is talking about failures, you know. It has become so fashionable that everybody is putting out failures even when failures didn't exist probably because it's so cool to talk about failure stories. But just take the example of someone like a Bill Gates or, you know, Bill Gates is talked about a lot, but he was not the greatest guy who had the best operating system. There was a guy called Gary Kildall whose operating system was several notches above that of the Microsoft operating system. But he and his wife just simply could not get along with the IBM team that had developed the PC. As a result of a lack of chemistry, the IBM team went and bought the second or third best product. They couldn't buy the first best product. So they bought the second or third best product from Bill Gates. And riding on the success of the IBM PC, the Microsoft operating system, you know, did well. And the rest, as they say, is history. And today, you know, people ask Bill Gates questions about everything. What does the man know about impact and poverty and health? He may understand a bit about technology. But look, but everybody asks him questions on those and expect him to give answers. So I think success places you in a position to where people will be curious about what you think on every topic, including those you don't understand. And people who fail in life, Gary Kildall, nobody knows about. Nobody talks about his stories. So I think acceptance of failure clearly is there, but will the world talk about failures? My answer is no, excepting for brief periods for, you know, certain specific reason.
Okay, just to wrap up on a slightly more lighthearted or less serious aspect, I'm curious about successful people, how they manage their day. I mean, we live in an era of obscene levels of notifications and distractions and so on. What is your top productivity hack?
See, I think everybody has to find their own productivity hack. For example, someone like Ananda Nilekani, he is not on WhatsApp. So if you have to get to him, it has to be only through email or a short message. So everybody has to find, some people are not on Facebook. I'm not on Facebook, but I'm on WhatsApp, for example. Right? Each of us has to find our own solutions to the noise around us. Social media, I think, has been very good in some ways, has been bad in some ways. Like every invention has got the positive sides and negative sides. Some of the ways in which I deal with this noise is that I refuse to be consumed by the noise. So, for example, I will never, ever buy a thing just because there is a discount, there's a notification, or there's a low price. I will go out and buy something I need, whatever it is priced at. So I just refuse to be consumed by noise. I stay away from the noise on Twitter. You know, people, the short fuse, the, you know, vitriolism on Twitter, hate, fake news. I refuse to participate in any discussion on topics like these, for example. I stay away very clearly. So I think each of us has a way of dealing with the noise around us.
Okay, lots more questions, but hopefully I'll get to them in future conversations with you, Hari. Thank you so much for making time for me very generously. I definitely hope to keep the conversation going.
Thank you, Hari. It's been one of the most, amazing conversations I've had. The best one of the best podcasts. I think you were very thoughtful in the questions that you asked. Very balanced, very patient in giving me a listening. So thank you for that.
That's it for this week's Startup Fridays. I'll be back with another conversation soon. Until then, have a great Friday and a wonderful weekend. I'm Hari Arakali. Thank you for listening.